Ho, ho, ho. That was lame. Ho, ho, ho. Welcome to a holiday edition of the NPR Movie Podcast. In the Christmas stocking this week, NPR film critic Bob Mondello takes a look at movies that reflect the less than perfect family gathered around the table. We'll have some thoughts about spending the holidays in the dark. And screenwriter and producer David Simon offers something to do on New Year's Eve by listing his favorite film moments of all time. But on the top of the pile under the tree, a visit to the real-life location of a new Christmas classic.
In Cleveland, tourists are flocking to an unlikely attraction. It's an old house in a working-class neighborhood. It was the stage for a low-budget movie shot 25 years ago, a Christmas movie that still has an enthusiastic following. From member station WKSU, M.L. Schultze sent this story.
Overlooking the steel mills on Cleveland's west side is a narrow two-story frame house on a narrow inner-city lot that, these days, rivals the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a tourist draw.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid.
Director Bob Clark started the house on its way to icon status when he filmed large parts of A Christmas Story in Cleveland 25 years ago. The house is now A Christmas Story House and Museum, overseen by executive director Steve Sedlecki and visited by 70,000 people over the last 4 years. Given all that attention, Sedlecki says it's hard to believe the $4 million picture flopped back in 1983.
It basically ran for a few weeks and got pulled from the theaters before Christmas. Christmas movie being pulled before Christmas, it's not a good sign.
Cleveland has claimed A Christmas Story as its own, though its only reference in the movie is Cleveland Street. The movie's supposed to be set in Indiana, but fans know better. They recognize Cleveland's public square and Higbee's department store, and they know the house on West 11th Street, where filmmakers recorded Ralphie Parker's quest for a Red Ryder BB gun. Sisters-in-law Jenny and Carrie Davis drove 2 hours to the house from Cardington, Ohio. They're posing next to a fragile crate with a leg lamp peeking out. It's a movie sight gag that hints at just how many people really do watch the 24-hour Christmas Story marathon on cable.
Everybody growing up wants some toy that they don't think they're going to get, and it's a great surprise when they get it, and everyone's dad says things they shouldn't and gets busted
yes.
doing that, and everyone has a holiday that just is a mess, and it's just one of those things that everyone in some way can relate to.
More than 4,000 people attended this year's Christmas Story convention on Thanksgiving weekend, and about 1,000 line up each weekend now to tour the house and see life imitate shtick. Danielle Kurinski is crawling out from under the kitchen sink.
After the oh fudge scene that Ralphie said the big word, Randy climbed under the sink because he thought Daddy was going to kill Ralphie. So you can't pass up the photo op.
Kurinski and friend Heidi Webb came from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and they brought their own props.
Well, she's got the bunny ears for the top of the steps when it came down as the deranged Easter bunny, and we have the glasses. We actually have an eyeball in case we happen to shoot our eyeball out. We have a BB gun, but we weren't sure we were allowed to bring it here.
Brian Jones opened the Christmas Story house 4 years ago. He already was making money off A Christmas Story by selling plastic leg lamps. And the lamps, fishnet stockinged and high-heeled, are ubiquitous in Cleveland.
We have in the actual full-size legs themselves, the nightlight, strings of lights, ornaments. You can get an inflatable one that you can plug into your front yard.
Fabian and Jenny Sandoval put the dog in the car and drove to Cleveland from Falls Church, Virginia, to buy a lamp. And though coworkers thought they were crazy, they also sent along shopping lists.
The decoder pin, the soap, and we need some of the ornaments and the nightlight, so we have to load up.
Christmas Story tourism dollars in Cleveland extend beyond the house. They include two official A Christmas Story House Chinese restaurants. The Cleveland Playhouse has just finished its 100th performance of the play, and a local hotel promotes weekend packages that include goodie bags of Ovaltine and Lifebuoy soap. Cleveland's Christmas Story pitch went even further this year. A Pennsylvania family bid $5,200 on eBay. What'd they win? The chance to spend Christmas Eve and Christmas Day at the house the movie made famous. For NPR News, I'm M.L. Schultze.
Sparkling lights, crackling fireplaces, cheerful, happy families. Okay, maybe not all those family scenes are so cheery, especially when they come from Hollywood. Sure, Jimmy Stewart, he had a wonderful life. But think about Bruce Willis stomping through holiday airports in Die Hard, or God forbid, Macaulay Culkin abandoned in Home Alone. Our movie critic Bob Mondello has seen them all, and he's put together a Christmas list of his own, the best dysfunctional family Christmas scenes ever. You can find the full list at our website, npr.org. I have Bob here. Bob, now that's a cheery way to get into the holidays.
Well, I gotta say, I go to see these movies every year. Every year there's at least one Christmas picture, right? Like Elf or something like that. Mm-hmm. And every year you dutifully go to them. This year I went to three, and they were all dysfunctional families. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting. There was Four Christmases, which actually goes to four separate dysfunctional families. Nothing for the Holidays, which is a sort of a Latin American version of that. And A Christmas Tale, which is the most dysfunctional family you've ever heard of in France, headed by Catherine Deneuve. And I just thought, oh my goodness, what is with this? And I started thinking about other movies, and frequently movies that are not about Christmas but that have Christmas scenes use those scenes to sort of undermine the family. Huh. And it's I thought that was really kind of an interesting thing.
These are a lot of dysfunctional families here.
Well, that's true.
Okay, I looked down the list. I have seen a few of them. Several of them I have not seen. Okay. The one that jumps out to me is Gremlins?
Well, remember, it takes place at Christmas time. And there is actually, I mean, because of that, there's a whole lot of Christmas stuff around that the Gremlins can hide in.
Yeah.
And at one point, there's a kind of an amazing scene where they go caroling.
Let's listen.
Christmas carolers. I hate Christmas carolers. Screeching voice, little blue snippers.
I warned you, Brad!
You remember? They're kind of wonderful. This takes the saccharin out of Christmas.
It
really
sure
quickly.
Does. Putting a gremlin in a blender totally. Sure does. Okay, the next one on the list, Love Actually. I love this movie. I really do.
Well, it's very sweet. The scene I picked was actually something that was cut from it, but that is on the DVD extras.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a scene, Emma Thompson, you remember, finds out that her husband is fooling around on the side, or at least making eyes at someone on the side. And so things are kind of rough at home. They're also rough in her son's school. He has written an essay about what he would wish for Christmas. Everybody else was wishing for world peace, for, you know, somebody to get better, mm-hmm. who's sick. And he made a rather strange wish.
I've thought extremely hard about what I would wish for at Christmas. But after long consideration...
You misspelled consideration.
Sorry.
Right.
After long consideration, I've decided this is my Christmas wish. That is, for one day, you could see people's farts.
Well, it's just so real, isn't it?
It is real. I mean, it's a real little kid moment. I just think it's really cute. And the way that scene resolves, I mean, you know, a lot of things go on during the scene, and she is, of course, appalled for the benefit of the teachers and things. But the way it resolves is so heartwarming, and it's just so wonderful. And it is what Christmas is about, you know? It just is.
Now, you have, Bob, put on this list a true classic, the movie Meet Me in St. Louis, which has in it a Christmas moment of all times.
Well, it totally does. The song Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which you think of as this lovely saccharine song that you sing at Christmas time. What a lot of people forget is the context of it in the movie. Remember, the family, the Smith family, is going to have to leave St. Louis, and they're going to have to move to New York, and all the girls are just miserable. And so Judy Garland sings this song to cheer up Tootie, played by Margaret O'Brien, and little Tootie sits in this whole thing with tears streaming down her. It's the saddest moment.
No.
It's gorgeous, but it's a loving family that is having this dysfunctional moment.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
NPR's movie man Bob Mondello, have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Well, thank you. And while we're at it, let's invite all the people to, if you go to the website, mm-hmm. you can actually vote for your own favorite terrible moments.
Oh.
And there's another movie poll there to vote for the best pictures of the year.
All of this at npr.org/movies.
Once again, as in olden days.
The holiday season isn't just about buying presents and overeating. It's also the time when movie studios release their top Oscar contenders. For that, commentator and film buff Mark Aceto is thankful. His idea of a perfect Christmas day is one spent at the multiplex. But over the past 30 years or so, he's noticed a few changes.
Gather round the fire, boys and girls, while I tell you a tale of Christmas past, of a time when families stayed at home on December 25th and didn't go to the movies. I know it's hard to believe. Walk into any multiplex in America on Christmas Day, and it's more crowded than a Tokyo subway, packed with stir-crazy revelers who've overdosed on eggnog and Uncle Louie telling you to pull his finger. But it wasn't always this way. In 1979, when I was 13, my parents divorced. In a move that was unheard of at the time, my father got custody of me, my brother, and Christmas. Because, as we quickly learned, holiday magic doesn't happen without a mom to act as magician. So my dad took us to the movies and saw Kramer vs. Kramer, a film about a mother who leaves her son to be raised by his father. And a happy new year. Back then, no one went to the movies on Christmas. I mean, no one. You could shoot a cannon through the place. We wandered the aisles, changing seats, and yelled back at the screen like it was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It felt subversive, almost forbidden, and I loved it. You see, family can let you down. They can disappoint you or walk out on you when you need them. But as long as there are Jews in the world, there will be movies on Christmas. When I grew up, I too moved out of state and fell in love with one of God's chosen people, who not only shared my holiday habit, but taught me the sacred Hebraic tradition of ordering Chinese takeout. Over the years, we've established a few ground rules. For instance, friends and family are welcome to join us, but we treat them like rogue nations. There's no negotiation. After suffering through Kindergarten Cop in 1990, my partner and I always choose the movie. We select our Christmas movies as carefully as others assemble their Christmas lists, often opting for themes like combining Dreamgirls with The History Boys, or Sweeney Todd with There Will Be Blood, the latter describing the former. This year, we're especially festive with the wintry-sounding Frost Nixon, as well as 7 pounds, which is exactly how much I will gain by New Year's. Each Christmas, I look around at the crowds of people who used to stay home and wonder if it's some reflection of our fractured families, a sad commentary on our disconnected communities. Or perhaps it's just a new version of a tradition even older than Christmas itself. Long before the birth of Jesus, civilizations celebrated the winter solstice by burning fires to urge the sun to return. The practice continues today as we brighten the darkest nights of the year with holiday lights. So is it really so strange that we gather together to watch a screen flooded with flickering light? Still, every December, someone with visions of sugar plums dancing in their heads looks at my holiday movie tradition with such pity you'd think I was Tiny Tim. Or even worse, Scrooge. But for me, any excuse to exchange silver bells for the silver screen makes me happy as, well, a kid on Christmas.
Writer Mark Aceto lives in Portland, Oregon.
We're going to continue now with our occasional conversations that bring you recommendations on DVDs worth renting. This morning we brought in David Simon. His many screen credits include The Wire on HBO. He created it. He also co-produced and co-wrote a miniseries about the beginning of the Iraq War, Generation Kill. He's been connected with so many other programs, including Homicide, and he's on the line. Welcome to the program, David Simon.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've got a list here that you've sent us of movies that you love, and you start with Paths of Glory. Stanley Kubrick is the director, and Kirk Douglas is the star. What's it about?
It's a World War I film, and it's about a French colonel who is confronted by his superior officers with the insistence that he select men and kill them as examples. So it's from the point of view of middle management, which is a point of view that I very much love. where the bosses are all bastards and good help is hard to find.
I'm going to have 10 men from each company in your regiment tried under penalty of death for cowardice.
Penalty of death?
For cowardice! They've skim milk in their veins instead of blood.
Well, that's the reddest milk I've ever seen. My trenches are soaked.
That's
that
just about enough out of you.
What it really is, I think, is the most important political film of the 20th century. I've come to love not only the film, but the book, Humphrey Cobb's novel from 1935. He was a World War I veteran. And wrote, I think, a magnificent piece about man and institutions and what happens in the modern world, in the postmodern world, between individuals and the institutions that they serve or are supposed to be served by them. And I think it's elemental, and I stole liberally from it for The Wire.
What makes that film, black and white, not too long, not too epic in scope, the most important political film of the 20th century?
Well, it really is about what happens when institutionalism becomes paramount, and the paradigm becomes what can you do for the institution, not what is the purpose of the institution or how can the institution serve you or serve society as a whole. Now, if you look at everything from what's going on Wall Street right now to how we got into Iraq, it's the same echo. You know, in season two of The Wire, one of the characters said, you know, we used to make stuff in this country, build stuff. Now we just put our hand in the next guy's pocket. That was a stevedore in Baltimore, but he could have been one of the French soldiers.
Well, now, were you also inspired in your work by another movie on your list here, The Wild Bunch, 1969?
Yeah, I have to confess, The Wire writers had a contest of how many lines of dialogue from The Wild Bunch we could get into season two of The Wire, and I think we quit at about 20. I eventually made a tape of all of the moments back-to-back and sent it to Waylon Greene, who wrote that screenplay, with just a one-word note that said homage. But the greatest line, I think, in that movie, and maybe in American film, is the very simple one of,
"Let's go,"
before the carnage at the end, spoken by Bill Holden to Warren Oates. And he doesn't explain it, because the film has explained it. And it's a moment of great restraint by a writer. And when I got to meet Waylon Greene, I said, you know, how did you manage to not write any more than "Let's go"? And he told me about these heroic battles and to prevent the guys at Warner Brothers from ruining the film with an explanation about why these guys are going to go to their deaths. And so I not only love the film for what it is, I love it for the writers having fought and won.
Fought to not write as much.
Right. Well, I can talk to you about films that I think were ruined in the last moments by explaining too much. Something The Wire was rarely accused of. but, I mean, you know, you look at The Hustler. I love The Hustler as a movie. Paul Newman, 61. Mm-hmm. But when he's playing pool at the end with Jackie Gleason,
yeah.
And he's come back to beat him now. He's grown as a person. He understands the world. He's suffered loss. He explains winning.
"That's the way he always told me to play it. Safe. Play the percentage. Well, here we go. Fast and loose. One ball. Corner pocket. Yeah, percentage players die broke too, don't they, Bert?"
You know, that scene should have been silent. That should have been done with looks, with eyes, with a word here or two, with a gesture. It's heartbreaking.
So that's a movie that did not make David Simon's list of recommended DVDs. And there's another movie here that did, actually. It's a concert film from 1964, the Tammy
Teenage
Show.
It stood for Teenage Music International. It was filmed in Santa Monica in 64. I think the movie came out a year later. It was in the theaters for like a second and died. Really what I love about that film is the last 12 minutes. The James Brown Band and James Brown and the Famous Flames come out. It's the end of his set. It's like Night Train, Please, 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 Try Me. From when he was at his height, from when he was everything. It is a triumph of American entertainment, of American cultural power, you know, African-American music at its height. I mean, it's maybe our greatest gift to the world is African-American music. You know, never mind baseball or constitutional government. You know, flatting the third and seventh note and sending it out into the world has probably been, you know, if America's remembered for anything, it'll be for that. And here it is. It's so perfect. And then these scrawny little pale-faced white boys have to go on after him because the Rolling Stones in 1964 are the last act up.
Uh-huh.
And you can see they're terrified. And what are they going to do to top what just happened? They're derivative of that music, but they're nowhere close to James Brown's authenticity and talent. And they're standing out there, and they got to play a Chuck Berry song. And in the last analysis, they somehow manage to do it. It's sort of this moment of what the power of rock and roll was, and its transformation by sort of young white kids post-war. And I just think that those 12 minutes are like everything that rock and roll was about.
Do you find yourself relating to that moment or identifying with it because you as a writer throughout your career as a journalist and as a screenwriter have dealt so often with African-American characters and tried to put words in their mouths?
That's very clever. I had not thought of that at all until you just said it. I don't know. I think I identify it with it as a kid who played guitar in bad bar bands and bad garage bands and never really had the talent. To, you know, I mean, I'm like every other frustrated kid with an electric guitar in his closet. I think what James Brown does in those at the end of that film, as far as human endeavor, the equivalent of, you know, I don't know, as far as American endeavor, It's like raising the flag on Iwo Jima or landing on the moon. It is magnificent. It is a triumph of things that could only happen in America.
David Simon is creator of The Wire, among other programs. Mr. Simon, great talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.